Hey everybody, this is Bad Grammar. This is Brendan Detzner, and I am here today with Ms. Kat O'Connor and Mike. And this is an example of that like lack of professionalism I think I just mentioned, because you just told me your last name, and I know it, but...
It's Michael Corlin.
Michael Corlin and Kat O'Connor, everybody. Thank you very much for coming.
Thanks for having us.
Oh, it's my pleasure. This is kind of interesting, because we've done a bunch of these, mostly with folks that I know and kind of have a relationship with, and whereas you guys are, I'm meeting you here for the first time right now. One little connection that's going on is that, Kat, you're part of the Terra Mysterium Theater Troupe.
Yes. And apparently you saw us performing. We did a staged reading of one of Gene Wolfe's short stories at, it was the Literary Hall of Fame induction of Gene Wolfe into, what was it, the Fuller Award, I think?
That sounds about right. Yeah. My impression of it is that it was the get everybody together in one place and tell Gene Wolfe that he is awesome, you know.
Yeah, pretty much. And yeah. All sorts of literati right. And this incredibly beautiful space.
I'm so jealous because I didn't get to go.
Oh, I'm sorry. Is this whole conversation going to be painful then?
He's one of my favorite authors and has been since I was a kid. You know, he's one of those you grew up reading.
Right.
And I was jealous enough when she was going and I couldn't be there. And
then I came back with photos of me of me and Terra Mysterium with Gene Wolfe and Wolf.
And the organ that you could, like, rent out three apartments inside
And Neil Gaiman poked his head backstage after we were done with the stage reading and said it was wonderful.
That was pretty cool.
Yeah,
I got to meet Neil Gaiman very briefly because I was there as an escort for someone with more juice than myself. You know, it was Tina Jens, who was wonderful, and it was totally a thing to go. And I totally got to meet Neil Gaiman's hand, and he was in fact the nicest. Like, it was one of those things where you don't expect from people that are fairly successful to, like, see the one person in the corner who is being polite because, and seek that person out, you know, and, like, look them in the eye and say, oh, hey, how are you? And then it's just, cool guy, cool space, insane space. I wanted to, the thing that really sparked my imagination was the train tracks going over the entire estate. This place is a mansion. It's, like, it's totally, like, you go up to it, it's surrounded by other mansions. There's this giant gate.
I'm sorry, but
they have halls full of Tiffany glass lamps and halls full of vintage Wurlitzer machines and Nickelodeon machines and all sorts of really awesome stuff. And
yeah, like the best point of comparison I could give is the House on the Rock, except that I mean, this is the guy that like saw the House on the Rock, but had a zillion dollars and just decided where it's like, what do you mean the orchestras are out of tune? Nonsense, you know, and just like, went to town with that. Yeah. But
incredibly beautiful, like Nickelodeons, and we got to play with them a little bit. And so the Wurlitzer is the big automatic pipe organ thingies.
Doesn't it have the biggest collection of automatic music
machines in America, I think?
Or something like that. Yeah. I mean, the only competition, not that I'm a devotee of these things, and maybe this, you know, I mean, like, the only comparison I could think of would be, again, the House on the Rock, which it was a peer, you know, at least on the level of, you know, it's a coin toss. And it's a private home is the other thing. It's just the guy lets folks in for charity, and also because what fun is it to have all that stuff and not show it to anybody? But
yeah. Also, the worlds are America's biggest pipe organ in the space where we performed,
and like the second biggest theater organ as opposed to church organ in the world.
Yeah.
I think
it has like thousands of pipes or something, and the pipes are like not just up in the front where you can see them, but they surround the walls in the space. It was amazing.
Yeah, it was very, and your performance was also very, it was a very, that's one of my, like that particular short story is something that, of Gene Wolfe's, is one that I've kind of like, it's kind of a go-to one for me that I like a lot.
The toy theater.
Yeah. So being able to see it is, it was a very cool thing. So that was neat. How did you get involved with the, I mean, are you, my brief reading of the bio, and this is because usually one of those things, this is like where I talk to people that, again, I've known for a while and realize I know nothing about them. But in your case, I'm just meeting you, so I have a little more excuse. But according to the bio, you came to Chicago pretty more, at least relatively recently. I mean, like a few years ago or something. Like,
well, I came to Chicago in late 2000, so I've been here for a while.
Okay, so it has actually been a little bit. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. And I've been with Terra Mysterium since, God, when was that? I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. It was 2007, 2008-ish, something like that. For a few years now. And I've been performing with them. I've been a member for a few years.
And how did, is the, I mean, what's the like, scale of activity for those guys exactly? I mean, is it just one of those things where it's like you all know each other and then every so often the spark happens and then there's a fire, or how does that,
well,
how
we,
does it work?
We usually do one major production a year in the fall. Last year was sort of a hiatus because we were looking for a theater space to perform in and couldn't find anything that wasn't already booked. So
right.
I think we're working on that for this coming fall in approximately 9-10 months. we do the one major production, and on occasion it's been like we go to the Chicago Fringe Festival and perform there, and that's our fall show. The last one we did, was at the Athenaeum. That was not last fall, but the fall before that. So that would have been 2013. And that was The Lion and the Serpent, which was a lot of fun because we use, projections and animation to kind of help us tell the story, because it was involving, it was involving a lot of fun stuff like magic and occultism. And
which is sort of the theme of the company, as
yeah.
I understand it, that there's lots of, like, the, I'm going to embarrass myself using words I don't know, but sort of, like, not like, witch kinds of things exactly, but, like, the hermetic kind of, am I on the right track?
Yeah, hermetic
yeah, yeah.
And occultism, and we kind of created a world around the character of Professor Marius Mandragore, who is a Victorian. He's a college professor, but he's also in The Lion and the Serpent, this is like the origin story. So then he was kind of a student of occult teachings and just starting to learn the magic and mysticism of that sort of stuff. And of course, in previous plays, this is the mature Professor Marius Mandragore, where he is a master of it, and he is teaching his apprentices of, you know, of how to do this stuff, and he's the professor, he's the teacher.
Okay.
Played by Keith Green, who is not that different from the character.
No,
he's the same kind of like.
Yeah, Keith Green is literally a professor in college.
So he doesn't have to, you get the, I think like if you, I taught school for a long time, and once you sort of get the cadence of sort of, you can just kind of slip into it, like, okay, everyone, this is what we want, you can just sort of fall right into it, and it's not that bad.
Yep.
Well, he's got that, but he's also got the theatrical sort of large projection.
Large production, and he's got this kind of very formal Victorian presence already.
Right.
So
is there some facial hair going on with this guy? Or like, what are we like?
The goatee,
yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he's a really good friend, and if you ever get a chance to see our shows, I invite you to do so.
So they worked. Okay. It sounds like. Well, I mean, there's not. We have. I mean, we just talked about this a little bit before the mic roll, but we actually there's like a list of things because you guys kind of get up to a lot of.
We get about up to a lot of things.
A lot of stuff.
Well, you
yeah.
know, when you're a working creative, you need a lot of different sort of streams to bring in the income and just to express everything you wanna put out there.
Okay.
So you know, it's really sort of a multidisciplinary thing.
Yeah, but it all comes down to storytelling.
Well, yeah.
I mean, this is. You know, a lot of people accuse me of having a lot of, like, very disparate interests. And it's like, well, not really, because it all comes down to telling a story. There are different methods for me of to tell a story, but it all comes down to that thing, that narrative.
Yeah. And it, like, doing different things, it's, you know, a little like rotating crops, you know, like,
yeah.
where you want to try a couple different things to carry one out. Yeah, do, I mean, well, doing prose especially with both, which both of you guys do. I mean, the metaphor that I think about it, at least, is this sort of like I've heard musicians talk about playing the piano as being something that you can like fake a lot of other instruments with, sort of, where it's like never quite in tune across the whole thing, but.
Right.
You know, and like writing prose is a little like that, where it's like, okay, you can have your little fake play, or you can have your little fake radio play, or your little fake movie for a second, but it seems to lend itself to being a core thing that you have other disciplines.
Yeah, and the advantage to writing prose is that you don't absolutely need anyone else to be in with you on that.
Yeah, it's like, you know, no one can make you, no one can stop you. Is the
my
right.
Cat has an opinion on this.
Oh, okay. Oh, well, maybe the cat can. Well, stop you. Or maybe the cat forces you to, you know, get your word count for the day, and sometimes
yes.
Where it's like, excuse me. 1,000 words for the morning. It's not that bad. Come on,
it's,
people. Let's do it.
Get to work. Get to
right.
Work.
Yes.
Get to work.
Yeah. There's the, it's a very loud cat, too. I don't know if you're going to get that at the audio for that, but it's a lovely animal. You guys can't see it at home.
He's very talkative.
Yes, nice. He likes to talk. And,
oh,
and
sure.
And now we're over here talking, so he has to come out and join the conversation, right?
Offer his... opinion where, well, I mean, I know that you guys, and this is, we'll call this a segue, but audio, I mean, you guys, we're using, rather than my usual, like, terrible microphone that's built into my laptop, we're using this, like, fancy thing that's looks like it came from the Jetsons, and you guys have this because you guys, in fact, do a lot of audio, audio work as well.
Yep, I got it initially to narrate audiobooks.
Uh-huh.
And so the fun thing is that like we have a little setup in basically our main hall closet where I'm crammed in among the boxes and clothes and actually clothes and blankets are really good for deadening sound, so
right.
It ends up sounding great
mm-hmm.
in a little tiny small room, so it's not echoey at all, so
right.
That's what I ended up doing, and then it just kind of snowballed from there. I don't know if you can hear him.
I hope so. It's great.
I think
you've got a quality, kid. You've got talent. You know, like you've just got. That's I'm talking to the cat. Everyone, okay. Any, but the, you know, but I'm sure that you know the closet. I'm sure helps with
the closet
cat related audio.
Yes,
oh, yeah.
and
mm-hmm.
some acoustical foam, and then it just kind of snowballed from there, which is a pun because this is a blue snowball microphone.
Yes. Okay. Right.
So we've expanded into other things.
Yeah, we're hello.
This is going to be the best podcast ever.
No, dude, this is well. I don't know how many of these you've heard, but this is well in the spirit of what tends to go on.
We've expanded
yes.
into.
It turns out creative people do own cats sometimes.
Yeah.
So you know, I'm sorry I interrupted you. What's
no,
up? Yeah,
fine.
Yeah.
We've expanded into audio plays,
mm-hmm.
and we'll be doing more of those in the future. It takes a lot of time and a lot of people to do a film, but there's a lot less involved with audio.
Yeah.
It's just
yeah.
pure audio. You have
and there's more of a audience for it than there's been in the last
oh, yeah.
few
yeah.
decades, at least, like century maybe.
It,
yeah,
it's,
like
it's really. Having a resurgence with the different podcasting platforms and everything else, you know, we're not quite at the point where we were with radio before there was television, but you can get an audience and it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, and it just seems like well, I mean, with multiple people, there's some equipment involved and there's some logistics involved, but
yeah.
There's less overhead. You know, you don't need to hire a DP to handle your very expensive camera to shoot. You can just set up your microphone and have people around your kitchen table, kind of like what we're doing now.
Yes, along these lines.
Yes.
What is the, and this is like, I'm always just kind of curious about, like, I mean, it sounds like you guys are full stop ahead. This is what you're doing all the time. This is like, I mean,
yeah.
Just about, yeah.
Like,
pretty
much.
I mean, pretty much, like, it's, is the, are you guys theater? I mean, then this is the kind of the sort of stealth theme that kind of keeps cropping up just because we're in Chicago and you can't wave a stick without hitting theater people, and you know,
you really can't.
And this is like, yeah, but
sometimes
even,
that's a show.
Yeah, sometimes that
sure.
is a show.
Yeah,
at the Fringe Festival or something, or
yeah.
Rhino Fest,
or different things. Yeah, I mean, it's just all over the Yeah, and that I know at least 2/3 of those acronyms are, and that's weird for somebody that doesn't have a whole lot of involvement in theater. But it's just because it's like, okay, if you're in Chicago and you're associating with creative folks,
you really can't walk 2 steps down the street without running into theater people here.
Yes.
Chicago is one of those big cities. It's also a very small city in a lot of ways. You know, the communities are very tight, and when you know somebody, you know everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the acting community especially, you know, we're all pretty tight, and that crosses over between theater and film too. You know, and the fact that we're pulling in more television into Chicago now, so that kind of is expanding a little bit too.
Sure. Do you guys like think of yourselves as being more like theater folks that have gotten dragged over into doing more prose things, and or I don't know if like again, the kind of prevalence of audio podcasting and stuff has anything to do with it, where it's like you can do prose, but you can also perform, and everybody can hear the performance part now, or I don't know how
well,
you guys view it.
I came from the theater and performance angle. Michael came more from the writing angle, and we sort of kind of collided in the middle.
And got chocolate in your peanut butter.
Yes.
I'm a writer. That's what I do. I started as a screenwriter. As a growth from my prose, I started in prose, and it's still where my heart lies. But I've expanded into film production and the audio and everything else.
That's my fault.
It is. But really,
he met me, and it was all downhill from there.
You get to a certain point, and you realize that if you want certain things to happen, you have to make them happen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm the kind of person that will take the initiative and initiate more projects than I can handle, probably.
Yeah.
But, you know, that's just part of being creative, too, is poor time management.
Yeah, or overbooking is
overbooking
a good sign of a furtive mind.
Or extremely ambitious to the extent that it's kind of more than you have time for. But.
Well, I mean, kind of the other fun thing just with the technology situation, like, is that there's more room for sort of, like, authors with an entrepreneurial kind of a bent to it, where it's a sort of like, okay, it's not happening, where it's like, okay, I'm tired of wallpapering my wall with rejection letters, I'm going to do X, Y, and Z.
Yeah,
yeah,
which is what Michael did. He went the self-publishing route.
Well, I was basically unemployed. I'd been temping and doing freelance work for a while, but that dried up in around 2010.
Mm-hmm.
And by 2012, I was like, well, you know, I have to start writing again, you know, I can't find a job, so I'm just gonna get back to what I was doing.
Do what you wanted to do in the first place.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, it's always been my dream to be a writer. It's all I'm really good at.
Mm-hmm.
It's the only thing I've ever wanted to do. So I started to, you know, write things to submit to local, well, not local, but to pro-rate magazines, right? Anything that pays 5 cents a word or more.
Right.
You know, which is something I did when I was in high school and then stopped doing because I was very poor for a while. I mean, I'm still poor, but now I'm poor and I have free time.
Yeah.
So I sent off a few stories to magazines, and then I started hearing about the whole the technology had advanced to make self-publishing viable instead of a vanity project. What with KDP from Amazon and the Nook stuff from Barnes & Noble.
And he kind of caught that wave like right when it was starting.
Well, it had started like a year earlier. When I got into it just as it had just crested and was no longer, you could publish anything for 99 cents and make, you know, a lot of money. When I got into it, there was still a lot of the advice out there was still as the market had been and not how it was. So I made a lot of mistakes starting out based on, you know, financial and business advice and creative advice that it was no longer entirely accurate.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to kind of adjust. Like, for example, Amazon had just changed their algorithm so that the 99-cent price point was no longer as good a strategy, you know. But I adjusted, and by the end of my first year publishing, I was pulling in 4 figures a month.
Wow.
Yeah. You know, I've been lucky with it.
Right.
So this is what I do full-time. I write full-time, and the rest of the stuff is other projects. The film stuff is something I'm hoping will take off, but to be honest, even if successful, it's not going to make us a lot of money for some time.
For a while.
Right.
It's one of those long tail, slow burn.
Yeah, it's a very long-term project for us. So we formed a production company called Burning Bridged Media, and we are working on a web series right now. We have just opened up the Kickstarter, which will end on midnight Tuesday night, the February 17th.
Okay, so as you are hearing this, or assuming that you're hearing this right when it's coming out, you got about a week to head over there, and I would encourage you to do that.
And
but,
check it out, yes.
Yes. And tell a little bit about, so you are writing it, and this is this is kind of like a 50-50 between the two of you guys. This is something you're both doing.
Yeah.
We're co-producing it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm writing.
Mm-hmm.
Kat is one of the actors. And basically, it's a web series that tells the story of a lab assistant who is leaking information about his the institution that's running this sleep study project.
Mm-hmm.
And it starts out merely sinister, but it gets very bizarre very quickly. It's sort of how would you describe?
Well, it's done in a found footage style because the conceit is that this is quote unquote actually happening. So the lab assistant character, you never see him in the video episodes, but this is a person who is the one who is responsible for putting these videos up on YouTube.
Yeah, it's a
mm-hmm.
transmedia storytelling experiment in a way, because we have the videos which will be posted to YouTube purportedly by the protagonist.
Right.
But we'll also
and the,
have...
the videos, if I mean, just based on the Kickstarter video, are mostly in kind of like a found footage kind of style. Like
yeah,
these are,
it's security
yeah.
footage, interview tapes, that kind of thing.
Right.
Whatever he's, this is his means of whistleblowing. He doesn't want to expose himself, and he's not quite brave enough to go to the authorities himself.
Okay.
So what he's doing is he's leaking stuff. So that he
mm-hmm.
hopes that somebody else more brave than he does something.
So this is the frame of the whole thing is the guy that's working there slowly
right.
sneaking things out to general
person
that
yeah.
is the audience.
Yeah, and
he's
hoping that someone who sees these videos will do something about it, whatever something is. He doesn't
yeah.
know, but the lab assistant is just like, you know, something must be done. I'm too intimidated to do anything direct myself, so I'm hoping that someone else will.
Okay. The kind of like emotional character of this sounds like it's a little bit different than some of the stuff that you guys are doing separately, where I mean it's like the scope is a lot more narrow. I mean, if it's just on one person's point of view.
Well, it's
then,
whatever videos he finds.
Sure.
You know,
yeah.
he's not in any of them. He's not gonna
okay.
expose himself that way. And,
right.
This may not be things he's witnessed personally, but it's whatever
mm-hmm.
videos he can dig up while working.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like we said, security footage. So if there's a security tape of something weird going on during one of the sleep study experiments, he'll grab that and then leak it to YouTube. Or we have the rough cut of our pilot up on our YouTube channel, and that's basically their...
three interviews.
Yeah, there
are
candidate interviews for interviewing potential subjects to be entered into the study.
And you get to see how the guy interviewing them basically blackmails them into agreeing to be part of this. You know,
okay.
By showing the scope that his organization has that goes far beyond what you would expect.
So it's a, like... you know, consensual, sure it is, kind of a situation,
yeah,
you know, where it's
yeah.
like...
Well, you could back out now, but...
But wouldn't
know,
it be a shame if...
You know, all of your
right.
horrible secrets...
Pretty nice grandparents you have there. Shame if anything
yeah.
happened to them
yes.
or something, like, yeah.
So,
nice secrets you have there. Shame if anything happened to them.
Yeah.
The tone is both conspiratorial, but also sort of a dark sci-fi fantasy angle on it, like...
Mm-hmm.
Like Cube, if you're familiar with the Cube
yeah,
movies,
yeah, yeah.
or,
mm-hmm.
or a little bit of Videodrome, you know, there's
mm-hmm.
just something going on. It's about, I mean, the whole theme behind it is how sleep deprivation changes your perception of what reality is. You know, you stay up long enough and things start to get a little bit surreal.
Right.
And this is sort of an externalization of that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it kind of deals with layers of reality in almost a... mystical sense too.
Mm-hmm.
It has themes of, you know, there's the reality that we're comfortable and familiar with that we perceive on our day-to-day lives, but there are layers beneath that we don't ordinarily have access to, unless something extraordinary happens, like being sleep deprived for a week.
It's almost like a Jungian cosmology where there's the different shadows of what really is. And there's what lies beneath that we don't normally have access to, but somehow this program is subjecting people to great stresses and they are breaking through one way or another into alternate perceptual schemas.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is this like, how is this something that you guys are seeing as having like a fixed endpoint? Where, I mean, it's obvious that it's not like a film where it's like, okay, 2 hours and then you're done because it's mixed media. But
it is a series.
It is.
And
yeah.
Each episode is basically one video that's being leaked. And collectively, they tell a story.
Mm-hmm.
It's not, you know, a direct narrative, but collectively it does tell the story, and you do get the sense of progression from episode to episode.
They're not necessarily leaked in chronological order in which they happened, but chronologically in the order in which the lab assistant found them.
And in a meta story sense, we're releasing them in the order in which this knowledge revealed to the audience tells the most coherent story.
Okay.
All right. So that's basically, you know, I'm releasing this before this because the audience needs to know this before they can know this, even if this happened to happen first. So there are three seasons plotted out. The first one is the first season is scripted. We're all done with the writing. We're ready to start producing as soon as as soon as we're funded.
Yeah.
The second two seasons are also plotted out, and we will. Once we have funded those, film those together, basically, so we can get everything knocked out. And there is an end point, and there is a definite end, though the viewers can influence and interact with what's going on, both in the comment fields of the YouTube videos and in an associated Twitter feed.
So influence what's going on. I mean, and I guess that's a doable thing it's kind of like a small, nimble production.
Well, exactly.
You can respond to. That's interesting.
That's
kind of fun.
A substantial part of the narrative is going to be what not only the videos that the lab assistant is leaking, but the lab assistant is also
interacting.
It's also like prose narrative through Twitter. And since Twitter is interactive, if you choose to interact with that Twitter feed and, you know, talk to the lab assistant, then you are also a part of co-creating that narrative.
And how much the viewers can engage with and influence the path the story takes really depends on how much funding we have.
Right.
Ideally, if I had all the money I wanted, I would do something that's almost like an ARG with it, you know, an alternate reality game.
Okay.
That extends beyond the videos and everything. But again, we would need a lot of money to pull that off.
Mm-hmm.
What the scope of this is entirely dependent on how much our Kickstarter raises.
Okay. Have there any been, because this sounds like something that is along the lines of things that you guys have both done, but still kind of something new. Has there been any surprises so far doing this, kind of working in a new medium or kind of in a different style?
Producing is a lot of work.
It is, yeah.
Well, you know, we didn't initially.
That's why they got so many assistants, you know? It's like, or ideally, they have so many assistants. But,
the main, that I'm doing this at all as a producer is a bit of a surprise because I didn't set out to. Originally, I was just writing it and I was hoping that
neither of us
else's production company
set out to be producers.
But the production company we were originally working with could no longer continue with the project. So after that, I shopped it around other local production companies for 2 years.
Something like
2 years after we shot the pilot, I was shopping it around. But, you know, the thing is with small production companies is that they have a lot of their own material.
Yeah, they want to do their own stuff, which is no surprise,
you can understand that.
Yeah.
And so I was getting offers, you know, if you give me, you can hire us for $60,000. And I'm like, well, I don't want to hire you. I want to, you know, make a project. I want to collaborate with you.
Right.
Because that's what we're all about is collaborative art, and that's what I love about film.
Mm-hmm.
The second big surprise is just how great our actors have been. Everybody we've been working with has been just truly phenomenal and devoted a great deal of their time and energy to the project, and they're all very, very enthused.
And still attached to the project.
Yeah.
After, and like, 3 years
yeah,
or something.
Totally.
Everybody's still around. That is pretty...
Yeah, that
is pretty impressive.
And
it's,
they're our
yeah.
biggest cheerleaders.
It's their
right.
enthusiasm that has pushed me to continue on with this. I mean, if
uh-huh.
nobody had been interested in continuing, I just would have moved on to somebody else, something else, you know?
Right.
I've got so many projects going on and so many ideas and so many plans, but since everybody is still heavily invested, I have no problem with, you know, staying invested myself.
Right. Okay. Well... This sounds like a very interesting project, and when this gets posted up, I'll be posting the link to it right up nearby and doing all that good stuff. And my understanding is that the thing that you are going to be reading for us today is from the sleep, from this project.
What are we reading today?
We're reading something today?
Yes, we are.
Oh.
Okay. You know, this is a fine chance for me to press the button, and we'll be back in a second, and then there will be stories and stuff for you guys, so. Okay, and we're back. And what do we got?
This is the beginning of Descent Macabre. It is a novella-length story. It's a very dark kind of psychological horror story.
Okay.
For one still, perfect moment, the only sound was a soft puff of her breath as it escaped from her lips, crystallized, and drifted away on the frigid winter breeze. What in the world am I doing wearing a micro miniskirt in this weather? Came the absurd thought a heartbeat later, shattering the moment. She wrapped her long black coat more tightly around herself as she walked the remaining distance down the alley to the door, the block heels of her knee-high black boots clopping on the pavement. What was she doing? She had dressed by instinct, distracted, preoccupied, and had found her way here seemingly through no conscious choice. She was simply here, and only vaguely aware of traveling the distance from her apartment. What was she doing coming back here at all? Returning to the scene of the crime. She was angry, but outwardly calm, and if she dared admit it to herself, more than a little frightened. A 3-day chunk was missing from her memory, and during that time, someone had apparently been very busy. She paused at the door, the low beat of the music throbbing its way quietly through the thick steel panel, and realized she was shaking, from anger, from fear. Fear of what she might learn on the other side of that door. Fear of her unknown attacker. Fear of herself. Fear of what she was becoming. Violated. Powerful forces surging through her. No certainty at all that she could control them. The fear had come first. But the anger had been building over the past 4 days since she'd awakened, and was now dangerously close to rage. She yanked the door open. As she entered, the music flowed over and around her, primal, haunting, sensual. The bouncer asked for her ID, and she showed it to him, paid the cover, checked her coat. There was a good-sized crowd inside the small club, but it wasn't crowded, just as she liked it. The Friday night regulars were probably already ensconced in their respective dark corners or swirling amidst the flow of bodies on the dance floor. She walked up the 3 steps to the bar, moving easily through the throng. She was glad she was wearing her heels. With them, she was a dead even 6 feet tall, eye to eye with most men and taller than some, and they made her feel powerful, intimidating. And tonight of all nights, she had no desire to be reminded of her vulnerability. Sliding her way between 2 small clusters of people, she leaned against the rail overlooking the dance floor, scanning the crowd. Several familiar faces were already present. Who was it? The one thing she had loved about this culture, this club, was that she could come here and dress, move, act, be as sensual as she wanted, and no one would try to make a pass at her or touch her without permission. Goths, she knew, respected each other's space. But no more. That easy sense of security had been ripped away along with 3 days' worth of missing time. Someone had violated the unspoken rule. Who was it? Nearly everyone was suspect. She had spent most of last Friday night hanging with other regulars, but she had danced, as usual, alone amongst the crowd. pretty much anyone could have seen her, decided that they wanted to possess her. It could have been some hidden personal vendetta, but damned if she knew of anyone she had offended in recent history, or a whim, for all she knew. Her eyes scanned back and forth, flicking from corner to shadow, taking it all in, the shapes in the darkness now more distinct, sharply defined, and, gods forbid, even more beautiful than ever they had been before. Black clothing, white skin, gray shadows, eyes shining with life in the dim light. Eyes shining. There was Aldous, as serene as usual, leaning against the back wall, a drink in his hand, a cascade of lace at his throat. Behind him, his dim, murky reflection mirrored his movements as he sipped and casually watched the dancers with his typical half-smile. And Cleo, pale blonde waif, undulating and flowing amongst the other dancers. Cleo, the very definition of a little slip of a girl, in a shimmering red-black slip dress, tiny butterflies in her whitish-blonde, untidily spiked pixie cut, iridescent glitter around her eyes, dark maroon lips standing out starkly in contrast to the white of her face. And Aaron, sitting next to the DJ booth, sandy hair dyed in streaks of midnight blue and worn just long enough to hang perpetually in his eyes. He was dressed head to toe in black PVC and was leaning with his elbows on his knees, intent on a conversation with two or three others. Eyes shining with life, her hands suddenly gripped the rail, knuckles turning white. From across the room, his gaze locked with hers, his eyes black, liquid pools, glittering with flecks of a preternatural red light. In her new sight, his eyes were brighter, more glorious than any others. But it was not life that lit them. Damien. Unconsciously, her lip lifted in a feral snarl. Across the room, Damien pursed his lips, frowning, shaking his head ever so slightly, the tisk-tisk evident in his far too amused expression. Quickly, she forced her face back into a neutral expression, ears burning, grateful for the semi-darkness, but furious that he should see fit to admonish her, never mind finding it funny. Even if he did have a point. The last thing she wanted was for someone to see something they shouldn't. Flustered, and doubly angry that he'd gotten her flustered, she glanced back at his shadowed corner. He was gone. Shit. Where had he gotten to? She straightened up quickly, ready to dash down the steps to find him. Never mind that she had no plan of action beyond that. She had found the bastard who'd done this to her. She was not going to let him slip away. And just as suddenly, there was a touch at her elbow, cool breath upon her neck, a presence at her back. She froze, his long hair brushing the bare skin of her shoulder, his lips, she knew, a mere inch from her flesh. Oh, gods! His lopsided smirk was evident in the soft, low tone of his voice. Do you love me now, my dark angel? It had been a perfectly ordinary Friday night, her first official outing since she'd moved 2 weeks before. Her best friend Jaden was plucking at her sleeve. Kat, you remember Aldous, she shouted over the music. We met when you were here last summer, Aldous supplied, leaning in to be heard. Yes, I remember, she told him, grasping his hand. Nice to see you again. Likewise, he responded, giving an elegant, ever so slight bow. It was Kat Aristova, wasn't it? She nodded. How are you taking to Chicago? So far, so good. Good. I trust I'll be seeing a lot more of you around this old haunt. Kat smiled. Sure, most likely. He returned her smile. Welcome back to Neo. He's here pretty regularly, Jaden offered, as Aldous drifted away onto the dance floor. Jaden was impeccably dressed, as usual, in a black velvet gown, her honey brown hair a pile of loose curls on top of her head, a style which Kat had yet to master. Instead, she'd opted for a tight, slicked-back French twist, slim black pants, and a stretchy black tank top. She looked good and knew it. More importantly, she felt good. Relaxed. This place had always been a favorite part of her visits. This place had always been a favorite part of her visits to Chicago, and coming back was much like coming home. The two of them leaned against the rail, watching the dancers, Kat allowing her mind to drift in time to the music. Aldous was out on the dance floor, his style as elegant as the rest of him. Much of his movement was clearly drawn from Tai Chi. He was one of the better dancers she'd seen in her lifetime. Yet, after a moment, another caught her eye. He was quite clearly in love with the act of moving itself, not concerned with trying to impress others by how it looked. And as a result, his movement was more exquisite than any other's. She watched him and was impressed, very nearly in awe. His movements were so polished she was certain he was a trained dancer, or had been. A tiny smile tugged at the corner of her mouth, and she stretched her hands and arms in front of her. "Who's the dancer?" she asked Jaden, nodding her head toward the dark figure below. "Him?" She watched him for a moment. "I don't know. I've seen him around here every once in a while, but I've never met him." She paused. "But, I think he's watching you." "Oh, really?" Kat's smile became a full-fledged smirk as she glanced back to the dance floor. Sure enough, for one fleeting moment, his face turned towards them, and she was certain he looked directly at her. "Excuse me for a moment," she said, straightening. "I feel like stretching my legs." "Oh, and what happened to giving up on men?" "That doesn't mean I can't dance with them." She walked purposefully down the three steps to the dance floor and slipped into the loose throng of dancers as the song changed. Peter Murphy, a crowd favorite. Kat's philosophy of dance was the same as her unknown dancers. Dance to feel good. The look, if necessary, would follow. In her mind, there was something purely natural and infinitely pleasurable in letting the music wash over and into and through her, with the movement, the flow, the fire arising naturally from the intermingling of flesh and sound. Pure, wordless, uninhibited self-expression. She glided and twirled among the bodies, her hands painting an aura around her body, uprooting energy from the ground, beckoning to the sky. And from the opposite side of the dance floor, another dancer watched, every few minutes his eyes catching hers, and holding for the briefest moment before one or the other would spin away, the slightest of smiles playing across their lips. One song blended into the next, and they glided closer together, the steady flow of movement around them seemingly pushing them, guiding them inexorably one toward the other. The dance was a living, breathing entity, and as a part of its flesh, they had no choice but to obey its command. Another song picked up where the last left off, and the ocean of dancers trickled away, the dance floor clearing until only two were left. Kat took advantage of the sudden extra space, the music propelling her in fluid arcs and curves across the floor. The two dancers locked gazes, circling one another like leopards on the prowl, each body making up one half of an intricate, intimate, silent conversation. Never touching, yet hands painting curves and lines and broad sweeps of light around the other's shoulders, arms, hands, torso. They danced to each other, for each other, and for one long moment there was only the dance floor, the music, and them, the only two souls in the entire world. There is no magic quite like this, she thought. The song ended, fading into the next, and the other dancers began to trickle once more onto the floor. She and her mystery dancer stopped, each acknowledging the other with a slight nod and bow, each slipping away into the darkness by the bar. She flagged down the bartender, asking for water, which appeared by her hand in the next moment. The dancer was sitting on the stool next to her, leaning back against the bar. "You dance very well," he shouted to her above the throb of the music. "Thank you," she shouted back. "So do you. Were you trained?" "Yes, a long time ago. Not so much anymore." He turned to her, a smile tugging at his lips. "You, on the other hand, dance like an angel." He offered his hand. "Damien." She smiled, accepting it. "Kat, nice to meet you." He raised her hand to his lips. "A pleasure to know you, my angel." That's it.
Okay. Thank you very much. Right. And Michael, what do you got, man?
I'm going to be reading the beginning of the first novel in my Galvanic Century series of steampunk fiction, Bartleby and James. The very first bit of it. Until I get tired and decide to stop.
Okay.
Because that's how I roll.
Excellent.
More water here.
Actually, yeah, if you could give me a glass of water. A little bit of background on this. I originally wrote this this part of this segment as a novella. It was, under 10,000 words long, and I sent it around to different markets before I started to self-publish. And, I had personalized rejections for it. They said, this is good, but it doesn't suit our needs at the moment. And rather than continue to send it around, I decided to just publish it myself because I had no money or time. She moves at times with the fluid grace particular to acrobats and dancers, and at others her motions are sudden and jerky, feral and darting. A bird-like tilt of the head, an abrupt twist of the spine, that's all the warning given before she changes, transforming from entertainer to killer, from elegant to lethal. My pet theory is that when she becomes the perfect assassin, she gains a new awareness of time and kinetics, her movements so graceful and quick that the human mind can only process them in sudden still images, like the frames of a zoetrope. Mere words can barely suffice to convey the purity of her movement. I have to think of her in alchemical terms. She's quicksilver. Bartleby strode the perimeter of my workshop as he spoke, quartz knob at the end of his walking stick clattering a steady metronomic beat against the brass fittings set into the walls. He did it to irritate me, of that I'm sure, both the tapping and the purple prose-drenched answer to the simple question I'd put to him. "That's all well and good, but who is she?" I asked. He turned away, cane rattling along the baluster of the staircase leading to the rest of the townhouse. "I swear, James, if you'd spend less time here and more at the club with me, you'd know what was going on in London. The social season doesn't last forever, you know, and the people find you odd enough as it is. I've little regard for the opinions of toffs or the clubs they inhabit." "But they're so useful, James." "Then save your patter for the swells. Just tell me who this spider woman is." "Nobody knows, and that's the thrill of it. She comes out of nowhere, a flash of red and black fabric, powdered white face, and the tinkling of bells, drawing near in that sinuous way she has, mesmerizing and captivating even those with the presence of mind to recognize her as a threat. What else is one to do but watch when presented with the beautiful specter of death? When I saw her, first it was the sheer oddness of the sight that stayed my hand. A small girl, slender of frame and fine of feature, dressed as a jester. She entered the airship impossibly through a port window 1,000 feet up." "1,000? Airships cruise at 400 or 500 maximum. 1,000 feet up to dance and pirouette through the crowd with precision and aplomb, and then someone was dead." "So what you're saying is that this woman killed someone while you stood and stared, slack-jawed." I hefted a long, slender blade, a weapon purported to belong to the assassin herself. It, along with the rest of the artifacts littering my workbench, made up the sum product of Scotland Yard's investigation thus far. With the Queen's Platinum Jubilee but days away, they resorted to commissioning our services as consulting detectives. There were older agencies, larger ones, many with a better reputation, but Bartleby and I had some small name for handling the more outlandish and sensitive matters. "That's not what I'm saying at all," Bartleby stopped, settling into a relaxed stance. "She danced, and then the American industrialist sponsoring the gallery flight was dead. I was watching, we were all watching her, but she barely approached the man. She went from her smooth, acrobatic dance to a jerkier sort of movement. She, I swear, seemed to flicker for a moment, and then her target collapsed." "You didn't actually see her cut him?" "Nobody did. Just like her prior victim and the ones before that. When we landed, the airfield physician gave the same diagnosis. Poor bastard had been nearly eviscerated. I later learnt that it had been the cleanliness of her cuts that had given cause to the broadsheet's effort to link her to the Ripper, one even going so far as to label her Jack's daughter before some other publications started calling her the Spider. Lord only knew why that name stuck when the half-dozen others put forth fell by the wayside. I'm honestly just grateful for the opportunity to have seen her in the flesh, Bartleby said. He ran his delicate hands over the rest of the evidence the Met had given us. Shattered glass, scraps of fabric, a smear of grease paint from a curtain she'd brushed against. While ignorant eyes might have seen nothing but bored fiddling in his actions, I knew Alton Bartleby well enough to know that his mind was working, collating the data it perceived, categorizing it, and making inexorable progress towards an inevitable conclusion. His methods were as singular as the old man's, retired these last 6 years, but came from a different genesis. Bartleby was a true savant, and while the great detective had always made his deductions look easy and natural, in my partner's case they truly were. Building conclusions from disparate scraps of data was as easy for him as deciding what to have for lunch would be for you and I. Deciding what to have for lunch, now that he found challenging. And if the enchantment she wove, then the death she delivered was the key to breaking it. Not that it mattered. In the chaos that followed, she escaped, somersaulting through the doors from galley to gallery, and from there, God only knows, back out the window perhaps, gone before a single hand could be raised against her. For 6 months, the spider had been the terror and scourge of London, an assassin without equal, a perfect murderess against whom no protection was adequate. None could speculate at what hand it was that moved her across the board, and she seemed to strike out without prejudice against all targets, her daggers finding ready homes in the innards of Anglican bishops, Turkish ambassadors, Union agitators, French statesmen, Royal Academy lecturers, and visiting American plutocrats alike. The only thread weaving together her web of victims was the exemplary security which with they protected themselves. Her partners in this danse macabre were the men no other killer could reach. You're fond of her enough, I said. She's news, she's scandal, she's morbid entertainment for peerage and hoi polloi alike. A penny dreadful come to wicked life. I'm honestly surprised that you haven't heard of her before now, James. You know how it is, I replied. When I'm working, the rest of the world fades into an annoying background noise which I can safely ignore. That hardly sounds healthy. The isolation helps me think. Truth to be told, while I don't care for most people, I didn't even like Bartleby coming down into my workshop. He felt wrong there, out of place, a grain of sand in my oyster, company in my working place, was always an intrusion. He knew it, and most of the time respected my desire for privacy, sending down meals in the dumbwaiter, or calling from the top of the stairs if matters were important. This was perhaps the third time he'd been down in my workshop. It probably wasn't quite fair, considering that his wealth had paid for it. In this social regard, Bartleby was my opposite. While I preferred the isolation of what he had playfully but accurately termed my lair, he was a social animal, flitting about the London scene like a hummingbird, supping at the nectars high society had to offer. A gentleman forever on the cusp of the latest fashions and trends of means, with an addictive personality and too much free time, he had fallen in love with the idea of the spider from the moment he saw her first lithograph. He eagerly purchased any publication that so much as hinted at her, dined and interrogated any that claimed to have witnessed her murderous performances, and had waxed melancholic at his own ill fortune in not having seen her himself, until that fateful airship voyage. His obsessions did not go unnoticed, and the expertise my dilettante partner's obsession had acquired led directly to the Home Office calling on us. Bartleby was in heaven. Even to those with the connections as influential as his, the evidence lockers at Scotland Yard were off-limits, and the crumbs available at auction were only those artifacts that the Met didn't feel were relevant to their investigations. As proud of it as he was, Bartleby's collection of spider memorabilia had been somewhat on the paltry side, things of value and interest only to the morbidly obsessed. But creative sorts live and thrive on just that sort of obsession. A fact I understood all too well, so I refrained from needling Bartleby about it too much. The evidence the police had transported to us, on the other hand, held treasures that Bartleby could only have dreamed of. Recovered murder weapons, shards of glass from her more explosive entrances mixed in with possible fibers from her costume, a bit of lipstick scavenged from the cheek of a victim she'd pecked while driving a dagger into his sternum, all of it tagged, logged, labeled, and displayed, laid out in my workshop. Bartleby abruptly rose and began to ascend the steps, seemingly having lost interest in the artifacts. I turned from the table to watch him go, befuddled at his abrupt change in demeanor before realizing that he had come to some sort of conclusion about the case. "Lunch, then?" he asked. Any conclusions? I asked. He ignored my question until we were in the entrance hall at the top of the stairs. I'd insisted upon my workshop entirely cut off from the rest of the basement, the kitchen and servants' quarters. It wasn't that I didn't like or trust them. I came from a working-class upbringing myself. While I find our servants less tiresome than Bartleby's peers, I do not much care for any company when I'm working, and Bartleby calls such fraternization with those he deems my lessers unseemly. I've concluded that I'm in the mood for a light fruit compote for lunch, Bartleby said. What shall I have Miss Hottie fix you? Bread with drippings, I said. No, Bartleby, conclusions about the spider. You've worked something out? What I cannot work out is your taste for bread soaked in last night's dinner. I'm rather well off, you know. You needn't eat like an East End factory worker. It's how I was raised, I said. I have little patience for small talk. It isn't my way. I'd grown up in a working-class family, raised by a father with little tolerance for idleness or affection for his children, and I preferred conversation be short and to the point. Bartleby knew this, of course, and his continued deflections were his attempt to rile my temper for his own amusement. I would not give him the satisfaction. Still, I had to wait with growing impatience and discomfort while the cook prepared Bartleby's compote, and again while he took his goodly time nibbling at it. It was a good 10 minutes of idle chatter concerning matters of little interest until he placed his napkin to the side of the plate, and abandoning the facade of disinterest he wore so very well. I say, do you know what I fancy, James? You fancy any number of terrible things. I fancy some entertainment. Do you care to take in a show? Is this related to the case we've taken, or have you just gotten distracted again? He ignored my hostility. Perhaps an Italian opera, something jocular. Some sort of drama giosco. Yes, how about Il Filosofo di Campana? Out with it, Bartleby. Oh, I think you'll like it. It's no opera buffo, but your working-class sensibilities will enjoy the intermezzi at the very least. I glared at him while the housemaid cleared our dishes away, but he seemed impervious to my sincere desire to throttle him with my mind. I am not a fan of opera, nor of any passive entertainment, really. It isn't so much that I am incapable of grasping them, as Bartleby on occasion has implied, but when I'm not working, and as Bartleby will tell anyone shortly after meeting them, I am always working. I prefer a good earthly carouse to sitting in some stuffy theater, watching painted men prance around like women and listening to songs I cannot begin to understand the lyrics to. I like things simple. I like things precise, efficient. Art is none of those things, and I dare say I'll never understand it. Still, through my association with my partner, I am not entirely ignorant of the venues the city offers to patrons of the arts, and I was thus surprised when Bartleby did not lead me to the Royal Opera House. He didn't lead the way to the recently opened London Coliseum or Sadler's. He instead traveled down a maze of side streets and walkways past pawn shops and brothels, almost beyond the outskirts of the city to what looked like a ramshackle warehouse worn by years of neglect. This can't be right, I said. Bartleby simply smirked, gesturing towards a hand-painted sign declaring that yes, Il Filosofo di Campagna was to be performed that evening, and swept through the front doors. The interior was in scarcely better condition than the exterior, dark curtains placed over cracks and gaps in the walls, paint and graffiti splattered over the plywood that seemed to be holding everything together. A small crowd of what I presumed were actors and crew hustled about, completing whatever construction they hoped would make the place suitable. It looks as though they're still building the theater, I said. They are, Bartleby said. You laugh, but I'm quite serious. This is an unlicensed troupe. They stay on the move, performing at a new temporary venue every other night to avoid the scrutiny of the police. What's the company name? They don't have one. I had no idea such a thing existed. Oh, yes, underground artistic endeavors are always the rage, don't you know? Of course, much of which they perform might be labeled as subversive by the small of mind or quick to judge. Plays about Fox, female performers, abolitionist manifestos, that sort of thing. I chuckled. You've got me associating with agitators and anarchists now. What's next, Luddites? Oh, only the most talented, I assure you. He made his way across the floor towards a young woman dressed in men's clothing, applying makeup to a young man dressed in women's clothing. Theater people. Lily, can you spare a moment? Oh. The woman didn't look away from the eyeshadow she was applying. Hello, Bartleby. The young man she was making up was dressed as something naggingly familiar, possibly some popular literary figure I wasn't fully remembering. "I've got something I'd like you to take a look at," Bartleby said. "If it's your John Thomas again, I'm not interested." Knowing my partner, I honestly wasn't shocked, and that disturbed me. Bartleby handed over a swab containing a bit of what I recognized as the grease paint from the police's evidence kit had provided us with. The girl took a quick glance at it, then grunted and slipped a wig onto her actor. With a cold shock, I realized that she'd been making him up to look like Queen Victoria. "Bartleby," I hissed, gesturing at the man-woman. "Yes? Oh, yeah, they're doing some show for the Jubilee." "Still under on the play route on that before," the actor playing the Queen said. "The band will be playing, I'll be waving." The girl had pulled out a jeweler's loop to examine the swab that Bartleby had given her. "It's got bits of mica in the oil. See that slight sparkle? Definitely flasher than the base he'd use as a foundation. And look at how bright the white is. Any of my actors would be a huge distraction." "Just as I thought," Bartleby said. "Thank you for your confirmation. Do you know who makes it?" She shook her head. "Nothing commonly available. I used to work with a stage magician who'd use something like this on his assistants. You should have seen the way they'd sparkle under the house lights." "A stage magician? How perfectly splendid. You wouldn't happen to know where I could find him, perchance?" Bartleby had once admitted to me a flirtation with opiates in his naval days. He seemed the type, at first blush, to be drawn into the languid purgatory of opium addiction, but any sensible man knows that the first impressions can be deceiving. "It isn't pleasure that my partner is addicted to, but experience, the new and novel, the strange and sublime. He confided in me that he knew almost immediately that he could not persist with his opium experimentation. If he had, he wouldn't have wanted anything else, and to a man like Bartleby, such artificial contentment is the world's greatest poison. Each opium den we visited in our search for the magician D'Agostino was more wretched and pathetic than the last. Old men and young, the poor and affluent of all races and nationalities lay insensate and uncaring, heedless of the amazements of this age of wonder we live in. I often wonder what it could be that makes the simple experience of living life so unpalatable to so many, that they'd rather lose themselves in such a numb escape. The attendants of the dens, while initially taciturn and tight-lipped, were all too eager to help once Bartleby had given them a few coins. The stage magician looked like many of the other addicts, an older man in faded clothing, leaning against a wall, slack-jawed with vacant eyes, cracked lips loosely held, holding a pipe, trailing thin wisps of smoke into the air. He was utterly unresponsive to Bartleby's initial attempts to rally his attention. I didn't so much as glance our way until I gave him a good hard shake. "D'Agostino!" The waste and excess had put me into a foul mood. "You! Are you the magician D'Agostino?" He muttered something that I didn't quite catch. "What?" "Illusionist!" His weak arms tried to push me away as he slumped to the side. "Prestidigitator! Never magician!" Pity and revulsion warred within me. Pity winning by the narrowest of margins. We weren't going to be getting any useful information out of this wretch in this state. I stood, still holding him, lifting the slack form of the illusionist to dangle by the waistband of his trousers. Bartleby turned to the den's attendant with an embarrassed chuckle. We'll be taking him home with us. Recovering from opiate addiction is a slow and painful ordeal. The body grows dependent on the drug to function, and when deprived, it reacts like a spoilt child throwing a fit. The detoxification process naturally takes up to a week, and we simply did not have the luxury of time. Fortunately, after hearing about Bartleby's experimentation with the drug, I resolved that if he should ever succumb, I should help him recover, and to that end, I built a detoxification apparatus. I really don't think this is entirely necessary. I don't know, if I didn't know better, I'd have said that Bartleby actually sounded concerned about the old addict. We can simply sober him up and ask questions later. "Nonsense," I said. "Look at this poor wreck of a man. We would be remiss in our social obligations if we did not do all in our power to cure him of this drug's grip. Besides, I hadn't been able to test the detoxification apparatus, and if there's one thing an engineer understands, it's how to take advantage of the opportunities that Providence affords. Help me strap him in." The apparatus took the form of a sturdy wooden chair reinforced with tin plates, having manacles and ankle cuffs built into the arms and front legs. A brass casing had been built into the back, holding an array of syringes set into a clockwork Gatling cycle, along with a pair of small phonographs reading from the same wax cylinder mounted at the base. D'Agostino looked barely cognizant of where he was and didn't react when I snapped the supportive brace around his neck. "Is that really necessary? Oh, absolutely. We don't want him thrashing about and injuring himself and dislodging the needles. While I may not like it when others watch me work, I do so enjoy explaining the operation of my inventions to an audience. Thrashing? Oh, yes, there will be a significant amount of thrashing, Bartleby. The apparatus is going to siphon out, filter, and recycle his blood and spinal fluids. I imagine that this will be quite unpleasant. I'm going to numb his brain's pain receptions, but there's still a goodly amount of needles involved. That sounds absolutely horrid. Oh my, yes. I began winding the crank that would regulate the needle's movement. But I'm no monster, Bartleby. See the twin phonograph horns? I should say some Strauss will help keep our illusionist calm during the procedure. I stood, clapping the dust off my hands, and we left the workshop up the stairs to the ground floor. Down below, we could hear the first strain of the Blue Danube beginning.
Thank you so much, Michael.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Okay. So for anybody that's interested in either of your guys' work, Kat O'Connor on Amazon, Michael Corlin on Amazon, and the Sleep Study Kickstarter will be ongoing right now as you guys hear this.
It certainly will.
Okay.
When you can find the Kickstarter, it's burningandbridget.com/Kickstarter. Very easy to find.
Okie doke. Thank you so much, guys.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Hey, everybody, one last thing. We've got a little extra bonus for you. This is a short clip from Sleep Study, which is the audio drama that Kat and Michael are Kickstartering right now. So please enjoy this.
This is Sleep Study Candidate Interview Series 8 of 12. Sitting across from me is David Savakis.
Yes.
Under consideration as candidate for Test Series 32A.
I thought this was supposed to be anonymous and confidential.
I can assure you that our studies are conducted with the utmost of discretion.
But you just used my name on camera.
You needn't concern yourself, David. This footage is purely for our own internal use while selecting candidates and won't be associated with the results of the study. I can assure you that it will be erased after the candidates have been chosen. Alice is 29, in good physical health, and has signed our medical release and non-disclosure forms. Her paperwork is in order. Would you care for some coffee or a soft drink before we start, Alice?
No, thank you.
So what do you do for a living, Alice?
I'm an internal marketing executive for an advertising firm.
I see. And what does that entail, generally?
Basically, it's a supervisory position. I lead my team of creatives and generally try to keep them on task and practical. It can be kind of like herding cats.
Herding cats?
Yes. Sometimes it's difficult to keep them on task. And artists aren't always the most practical people.
And does this lack of practicality frustrate you?
No, not really. Well, maybe a little. I just feel responsible for them. Frankly, I don't know what they would do without me.
I see. Did the woman who recruited you explain the nature of the study?
She did. I believe she said it was some sort of new insomnia treatment.
Close, Alice. We're studying the effect of sleep deprivation on the human nervous system, particularly as it pertains to the perception of reality. It has been explained to you that this is a 3-month study?
Yes, Kathy did mention that. I assume that means I'll be sleeping in one of your labs?
Not quite. During phase one, you'll be sleeping 6 out of every 24 hours at home and taking the pills that we give you. Every Friday, you'll come into the labs for testing so that we can calibrate your dosage.
Pills? What kind of pills?
Just something to help you stay awake.
What, like amphetamines? I don't want any speed.
Don't worry, Maria. We're mindful of the medications you're taking. These won't interact with your methadone in any significant way or show up on any drug screens.
I never said anything to Kathy about being in a methadone program.
Like I said, don't worry, Maria. While lying on your application is certainly grounds for termination, we have elected not to take that action at this time. Going forward, we do encourage your honesty, however, for your own safety and our accuracy. During phase two, you'll be spending Friday nights in our labs. The rest of the week, you'll be sleeping on the schedule we set, wearing a monitoring device which we will supply you with to ensure that you're not napping during the day.
I'm not allowed to nap.
If the device detects you dozing during the day, it will administer a minute electrical shock to help you stay awake.
Whoa. You guys are going to be electrocuting me?
It's just a small shock. Like a dog's obedience collar. Don't worry, David. It's for your own protection. If you sleep when you're not scheduled to, you'll be terminated and forfeit any pay owed you. It was all spelled out in the terms and conditions you agreed to when you signed up for the study, David.
Okay. Well, I guess I should have read the terms and conditions a little bit more carefully.
Yeah, I suppose so. Mm. Now, during phase three, you'll be confined on site in our laboratory and under constant surveillance and deprived of sleep every other week.
For an entire month?
This was all covered in the release you signed, Alice.
Okay, but I don't know if I can stay awake for a whole week.
Don't worry. Falling asleep during phase three will not result in termination. Staff will be on hand to wake you again promptly.
Okay, but a month in my line of work is like an entire lifetime. I don't know if I can be away from my team that long.
You feel your team is incapable of doing their jobs without your direct supervision?
No, but I'd like to be involved in what they're doing.
So you obsessively micromanage.
I prefer to take a direct hand in things.
Well, I don't think I can just disappear from my life for an entire month.
Our records indicate you're currently unemployed, Maria, and have no outstanding social obligations.
What?
You have few social connections beyond your family, all of whom live on the West Coast. It's what makes you an ideal candidate and why you've advanced so far in the selection process.
Kathy never asked me anything about that.
We collect data on our prospective subjects from a variety of sources, Maria, not just the initial interviews and paperwork. We're quite thorough.
Well, I have a boyfriend.
In the hospital. He's being taken care of, though I imagine the corticosteroids he's on are a great deal more expensive than the methadone. How long do you suppose the county's insurance will continue to cover him?
I don't think I'm going to move forward with this.
Why not?
Because you're being inappropriately invasive. And because I don't want to be electrocuted or locked away in a lab for a month.
If you leave now, you'll forfeit any pay that's already been offered you, Mr. Savakis.
I'm sorry, but I'm not comfortable with any of this.
Does your wife know you're gay?
What?
Action. Do they itch?
Itch?
The scars, do they itch? Your wife, does she know you're gay? Our records indicate that you've worked very hard to keep your sexual preferences hidden, David.
Your records? How did you...
It's bad. It's real bad. The docs say his liver is shot, and with his history of substance abuse,
They don't want to waste a donor liver on someone who might ruin that one, too.
Yeah. I suppose I can sort of see that, you know. I mean, never trust a junkie, right? But you know, he's been clean. He's really been clean. We both have for over a year. I mean, you know, people can change. We've changed. It's just the stupid system that there's no one to even talk to.
You can talk to me, Maria.
What can you do?
It is vital to our program that our subjects stay focused on the study and not distracted by external concerns. If getting your friend to the top of the waiting list is what it takes to keep you on board, then that's what it takes.
You can do that?
We can do a lot of things. We have a very thorough background investigative process, David. Research indicates you've tried very hard to keep your personal and professional lives separated. It would be a shame if a rash decision were to endanger such a careful division.
No. No.
I can assure you that your sexuality has no bearing on your suitability for this sleep study, David. We here at the Institute do not discriminate based on race, religion, gender, or sexual orientation.
This is blackmail. You're blackmailing me.
Your father-in-law got you that job, didn't he, David? Close friends with your direct supervisor.
Keep my wife's family out of all of this.
Seems like a harsh man. Must have been a difficult courtship.
What do you want from me?
November 3rd, 2006. Alice Robinson was admitted to St. Mary's in critical condition with two self-inflicted lacerations. One on each wrist.
You know what, you can't just do
this. Was this a cry for help, Alice? Did you go down the road or just cross the street?
Shut up. Just shut up. You can't know
this.
On
November 5th, following a psychiatric evaluation, you were committed to a state facility for observation and treatment, deemed a high suicide risk.
No, no, no. Can you stop this, please? Stop rolling that.
Sorry, Alice. I'm sorry. If that's what it says right here, see, high suicide risk.
You know what? I don't care. I don't have to stand here, and I don't have to listen to this.
Sit down, Alice! But you've gotten better since then, haven't you? Turned your life around. Got a new job and a fancy office. People have confidence in you, depend on you. They see you as the queen bitch of the office, don't they? You're the one in control. You're the one who's powerful and in charge. None of your subordinates have any idea that it's just a facade. None of them know that. And underneath it all is a sad, scared little girl who goes to bed with the light on and cries herself to sleep every night. They think that mask of composure you wear is the real you, don't they? Don't they?
Yes.
And that's all that keeps you going. All that keeps you from stepping off the train platform or taking a whole bottle of pills or cutting your wrists again. And all it would take to shatter that safe little world is the release that simple medical report.
You can't. You can't do that.
Why not? You're looking a little pale, David. Would you care for a bottle of water?
Thank you.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that. Could you repeat it more clearly, this time for the benefit of the camera?
Fine. I'll do the fucking study.
Excellent. This concludes candidate interview for David Savakis, subject date of 12 on September 18th, 2011.
Bad Grammar is released according to a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial 3.0 Unported License. You can get the new Bad Grammar at iTunes and in the listen section of Brendan Dessner Online the first week of every month. If you'd like to support Bad Grammar, thank you very much. We're good, but we would encourage you, if you're feeling generous, to go ahead and check out www.protect.org to learn more about a cause that we wholeheartedly support. Our theme music is lovingly provided to us by The Gotsicles. You can find out more about The Gotsicles over at www.gotsicles.com. And that is it. Thank you so much for listening, and I will see you here next month.